ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not exactly wise to speak out against the war inside Russia.
No, Geraldine. So when a leading Russian oligarch starts sounding alarm bells, the world pays attention.
There are consistent voices that are apparently unhappy with the direction of the war.
Could that hint of failure start to affect Putin's image?
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Latika Burke. Let's go roaming. Geraldine, I believe today's guest is someone you met on your incredible travels across Europe.
Yes, I did indeed meet our guest, Konstantin van Egert, in Vilnius, actually, in Lithuania. I went to one of the first things that I did, went to Poland and Lithuania. And of course, I hadn't really properly been to Eastern Europe. You know, I've been fortunate enough to have travelled in Western Europe widely, but not Eastern Europe. And it's just a completely different experience, which I know you know about.
Well, I haven't been to Vilnius. So that is definitely one you've got on me there.
Pearl of a city. Lots of ghastly things happened there in the past, of course, which you're confronted with. But look, I think you just, when you're there, they sit right by Russia. They have a very different attitude, honestly, they do, to their neighbour. And they're completely unyielding about the capacity of Russia to change. We keep asking questions, you know, how many times we've done it on Global Roaming, saying, surely there might be some change coming. And they persistently say no. Now, I think a lot of us dream of there must be some shift, we think, and that's really what we're trying to test today.
Well, let's bring him in to ask exactly these questions. Konstantin van Egert is a distinguished journalist and political analyst with Deutsche Welle and the former editor-in-chief of the BBC's Russian Bureau.
Konstantin, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you have spent your career thinking about Russia, reporting on it, being Russian. How would you characterize Russia as you see it today?
A country in deep moral crisis, which will not end even if the war ends tomorrow. That's, for me, the main thing which overarches everything, including the Putin dictatorship and the current aggressive war. This crisis predates this war, and it will continue after it's over. So it is a country in very deep moral, and because of that, all other types of crisis.
What do you mean by the morality conditions existing pre this war? What exactly are you talking about?
It is a country with population, but without citizens in the political sense of the word. It is a country which doesn't care about the war that its government is waging on a neighboring, completely innocent neighboring country. It is a country which agrees that being a mercenary for whatever, 30, 50,000 euros is a pretty honorable profession, and that's how the majority of the Russian military is now recruited, or at least the significant parts. It is a country which only becomes agitated when Ukrainian drones hit the Russian version of Amazon facilities near Moscow and starts asking why. We're not to blame for anything. This is a country which refused to support its opposition leaders, including the late, great Alexei Navalny, over the last, you know, two decades of Putin dictatorship. I mean, if this is not a country in crisis, then what it is, I don't know.
I suppose, is that crisis deepening or not? That's what I think we're particularly keen to find out, whether there are shifts that you can detect. And this amazing piece by the Andrei Melnichenko, who's one of the big oligarchs in Russia, giving this big interview to and writing an essay for The Economist, is really what seems to, well, people are wondering what it means. Why has he spoken out now? It's a most intriguing essay. I'm going to recommend to listeners that they do take the time to...
It is not at all. It is not really? At all. There's nothing intriguing about it, and I think it's a great dishonor to my acquaintance Arkady Ostrovsky, the...
Russia editor.
Economist Russia point guy, to participate in this Kremlin window dressing operation by someone whose companies continue to fuel the war in Ukraine. Now, this is a typical... Well, for lack of a better word, specialная операция, special operation to convince all those in the Western, well, political and business circles that, you know, there are good people in the Kremlin. There are some sane people. You know, if only you just forget everything, we'll probably do something good. We'll probably stop the war. But, you know, then there are conditions. And it's very funny that this Melnichenko guy is listing a lot of things that the West should do to Russia, but has pretty much nothing to say about what Russia has to do to Ukraine. And, you know, it is farcical. And I think it's a great dishonor to The Economist to publish this piece of Kremlin propaganda. There is nothing, if you lived in Russia for as long as I did, there is absolutely nothing interesting about it and nothing mysterious. It's as plain as a Big Mac.
So, Constantine, there is no sign in this of oligarch fatigue with Putin that would warrant publishing this?
There are no oligarchs in Russia. There are, they're called oligarchs, but these are people that are allowed to keep the money for as long as Putin allows them to keep it. The moment Putin says, by the way, you're a nobody, they are nobody, they go to jail. Just ask Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who spent 10 years in jail. This idea that there are some kind of separate oligarchs or separate civics or separate something in Russia is absolutely ludicrous. The West should not delude itself into thinking that there are some rich people who think, oh, by the way, we are so powerful, we will overthrow Putin. These people leak Putin's boots. I worked for one when I worked for Kommersant, the biggest Russian media group. And I remember the owner, Alisher Usmanov, transmitting in person instructions from the junior Kremlin staffers to us, for example, on how to cover Putin's divorce in 2013. For God's sake, forget it. Money in Russia means nothing. As opposed to, let's say, the US, if you look at Donald Trump, in the US, money breeds power, at least frequently, let's put it like. Not always, but frequently. In Russia, it's completely different. In Russia, power breeds money. If you control the administrative resources, you control the economy. And whoever was lucky enough to grab a piece of former Soviet property, and by the way, I have nothing against privatization. I think it happened as it happened. In 1990s, under Putin, became completely subjugated to the FSB-run and essentially Putin-run states. It doesn't matter how much you are valued at. I mean, 10 billion, 20 billion, doesn't matter. An FSB major can come and arrest you, and you will not even shake your finger to protest. Definitely, there are lots of people who understand that things are going in the wrong direction in Russia. I mean, you don't have to be super duper intellectual to understand it. If drones hit 1 kilometer from the Kremlin, then something's really gone pretty wrong. But Russian regime is based on a very simple deal: corruption in exchange for loyalty.
Well, isn't it? You stay out of politics and live your life and we'll run the country.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the moment you act, you're gone, because there's a file on you, on Putin's table.
But you also told us, when we were lucky enough to meet you, that Russia changes after dramatic things occur. And I suppose the question is, we're hearing that some market research people are doing research and finding that there's a seething discontent, which was the phrase they used, building inside Russian people. You don't even like the word citizens because you think it doesn't apply. And that they're starting to sort of say a pox on all powerful people who wish to be powerful. So are you saying that this could never shift, short of sort of a 1917 uprising or something? There can be no shift here?
No, I'm not saying there's not going to be a shift at all. What I'm saying is that for this, you need a much more dramatic development. You need to have the Russians not with their backs to the wall, but their backs becoming a wall, for them to finally act, if you're talking about the people. If you're talking about the rich people, of course they probably want to get rid of this dictatorship of fear. No human being likes to live in fear. But question is, what will be the push for them to act? If this war continues as it does...
Which is failing. It feels as if it's failing. Do you think it feels like that?
I think that it will take not 10 drone or 20 drone or even 100 drone strikes to change the situation. You need a dramatic thing. You need something along the lines of probably the Ukrainians retaking the Crimea. Or probably a banking crisis, not just one bank, probably Sberbank, the biggest state bank, collapsing and people suddenly finding that, I mean, they just don't have any rubles to spend. Or a major city like Moscow being left without electricity and fuel for a few days with, I mean, I'm afraid to say it, riots and stuff like that. Then maybe something will move. But one thing we do not know, and will not know until and if it happens, is whether there is a group of extremely patriotic officers who think, by the way, we need to overthrow Putin. And they gather in the woods or in a sauna and talk about it. And then finally they will move their, whatever, two divisions to surround Moscow. Maybe it will happen, but we will know about it only when it happens.
And in that instance, would that lead Russia to a more nationalistic outcome?
Yes, I think it's quite probable. I also think that if Russia's defeated on the battlefield and has to withdraw to 1991 borders, then there's going to be some kind of reckoning, but the public mood very soon will turn to this kind of line of thinking that, yes, we always knew that Putin was a dictator. We always knew that Putin was corrupt. You know, we lost the war because Putin and his team were bumbling idiots and greedy sort of idiots. And because of that, we lost the war. We should have won the war. We would have won the war if only we had a different leadership. And you know, there was this wonderful guy, Prigozhin, who they killed in 2023 because he wanted to wage an honest war, because he wanted to take the generals to task and tell them, pay decent salaries, do not steal. And then we would have been in Kiev parading our tanks on the Khreshchatyk. I think that very soon will be the taste of the month. I do not think we have any kind of chance, or at least a big chance. It will be a miracle if Russia gets some kind of reckoning with its past the way, I know, the Germans did after the Second War. For that, Germany had to be occupied. And even then, the reckoning did not happen until maybe 20, 25 years after the end of the war.
You're listening to Global Roaming with me, Geraldine Doogue, and Latika Burke, and we're speaking to Constantin von Eggert. He's a political analyst and host with DW, Deutsche Welle, talking about Russia.
Constantin, I feel like it's important to note here, you mentioned the great Alexei Navalny in the start of this interview. I mean, it is so obvious to Ukrainians that Yulia Navalny, Alexei's widow, when she goes around on the circuit, the international circuit, she does not say things like Ukraine must be sovereign and independent, there should be an end to Imperial Russia. In fact, a lot of the opposition figures in Russia who remain have trouble voicing that view. So even if we were to very crudely use the term the good guys, this strain in Russian thinking is still going to dominate, isn't it?
Yes, but let's face it. Yulia Navalny is a nobody. She's a political zero. I'm not afraid to say it. And the fact that she has a name does not mean she has the guts and the brain and the strategic thinking. I think what we see now from a distance, and I was not a big fan of Navalny. I knew him. I think the great thing about Navalny was that he could evolve. And what seems to have been happening before he died in prison, he reassessed a lot of stuff he did before, including, by the way, chasing the so-called Putin majority. That's why the Ukrainians don't like him, and I understand why. But I think that he was the only person who had strength and leadership qualities to evolve and eventually say unpleasant things to the Russians. I do not see such people today, or at least I do not see people that would combine this strength of character, popular appeal, and boldness.
With respect, would you be able to see it? I mean, isn't that the whole thing, that somebody could be just hidden in plain sight deep in some of those organs like the FSB? I mean, you know, he himself emerged. This was from the old KGB. I suppose that's what intrigues me. Is there any sense of movement that you can detect at all that could be ready to capitalise on this sense of a failing czar? Russians will allow people to take on a military operation, but you've got to win it. And he's palpably not winning it. So might this not portend something that isn't easily able to be seen?
Jolien, I'm sure that there are people that understand that things are going in the wrong direction. I do not detect anything but very timid hints by people like Sberbank chief German Greff, and especially those in the economic sphere, saying, well, you know, things are not exactly going well. There are a couple of formerly very, very pro-Putin, super-duper patriotic bloggers that are now saying, well, you know, thing is not going in the right direction. The commanders are stealing. The Ukrainians are much better in technology and much better motivators. Yes, there are things in the open. I do not detect so far anything that would hint at either a popular uprising or some kind of major elite movement that indicates some kind of split at the top. Putin is evidently not the Putin we've seen even like 5 years ago. I don't mean he's misinformed completely, but I think that the problem is that people tell him, you know, there are problems, but we're working on them. Mm. And Putin being, by the way, quite indecisive, and he doesn't like having responsibility. He says, okay, you work on it, yes. And so it goes. It's a permanent problem-solving process which keeps Putin assured that things are under control. And I think that people see it. Any war like that waged by a dictatorship never works for a dictatorship. It's nearly 5 years and they're trying to crush a country which is not a nuclear superpower, which is 3.5 times smaller in population size, or at least was. It's clear it's not going to be won, this war. And I think a lot of people do not understand, why do you need this piece of Donbass, which is anyway devastated and in a complete shambles? But asking this question means subjecting yourself to, at best, prison. At worst, they may drink the type of tea that the late Alexander Litvinenko drank in London in 2006. So it's something that people consider.
Konstantin, there's another dynamic you haven't mentioned, which is the United States. Now, obviously, Trump has swayed back and forth on Russia and Ukraine. But what we do see in the last few weeks is perhaps a more solid position from the Trump administration that is firmly pro-Ukrainian and certainly backing in NATO and pro-Ukraine. So is that going to have any impact on the thinking in Russia and the outcomes?
Yes, it seems. I agree with you. It seems like in the last few weeks there is a much more sturdy and stable path towards a more pro-Ukrainian position, for lack of a better word. I do hope it will continue. If it will, then yes, it will have an effect. But on the other hand, we hear that Kash Patel, the FBI chief, is preparing to travel to Moscow. Why? Why do you need to send anyone like that to Moscow? It's nothing but showing that Putin is still a reasonable person we can talk to. And I believe that there is a section of the US administration, maybe including J.D. Vance, people who think that you can still talk to Putin. It's also these people that think that you can play the do a reverse Nixon, as they call it, you know, play Russia against China. This is a complete pie in the sky, in my view. We'll see what will happen to the Russia sanctions package, or rather the package of sanctions against third countries that trade with Russia. That will be a very important thing to see. I will reserve my judgment until I see more resolute steps to confirm that this is indeed the Trump administration line.
What about the role of China in all of this? It is believed that this forever relationship between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin is one where Xi Jinping doesn't like any talk of nuclear at all, while there is a view that if Putin sees himself as more of a cornered rat, that he'll double down. Do you think they are influencing the course of events?
Yes, indeed. The Chinese, they do not want Putin to use nuclear weapons because, A, I mean, they are still the weakest of the three in terms of the nukes. Also, that will completely overturn a lot of things in the world if it happens. And none of them will benefit the Chinese. On the other hand, the alliance between Putin and Xi is a strategic alliance. It doesn't mean they agree on everything. For example, I don't think that Putin agrees to give away the Russian Arctic to the Chinese. Mm. But I do think that they see a lot in common in terms of confronting the US and the collective West. And this will continue. The Chinese probably want this type of regime to continue. What they would not want to see in Moscow is a regime that will come after the defeat in Ukraine and say, you know, we are completely spent. We need to rebuild relations with the West. We need to stop dreaming about no attacking NATO or whatever. We need to concentrate much more on domestic affairs with at least a kind of benign attitude. This is what the Chinese would not want. They would not want, for lack of better description, a Gorbachev or Yeltsin number two, because they will feel there's going to be a pro-Western shift in Moscow, and that will eventually lead to the US and the Europeans telling weakened Russia, by the way, why don't you do this and this and this about the Chinese? I think what they want a Russia that's permanently dependent on China, that is not also winning in Ukraine, because then the regime in the Kremlin will start talking different tone to the Chinese. More of the same, I think, is what satisfies them. On the other hand, I do think that there are elements in the Russian system that do not want dependence on China. Again, it doesn't mean they're going to have an uprising tomorrow. But I do think there are also elements that should be. Elements in the Russian bureaucracy that think, okay, well, we managed to survive without the West for the best part of this kind of 5 years. China is stable. Or they think it is. I'm not saying it is. China is advancing in technology. It managed to combine authoritarianism with economic development. Again, I'm not judging. I think that a lot of it is really sort of a skewed thinking, but it's what they think. So why not China? They are not putting demands on us. They are not telling us how to run our domestic affairs. They are not concerned with, you know, human rights and all this stuff. So I'm sure that there is a section among the FSB and all the military industrial complex and people like that, people with resources, by the way, who think it's okay. Why not? And I think that this is something that needs to also be understood, because the generation that remembers the Soviet Chinese, the Khrushchev and Brezhnev Mao Cold War is pretty much gone now.
Yeah.
And I think that one has to take on board the idea that there will be different views of China in Russia.
It's a sort of awful status quo you're describing. Konstantin Von Egger, thank you so much for joining us with those very brutally realistic assessments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Konstantin Von Egger, a long-time watcher of Russia for the BBC and others, now Deutsche Welle. Well, that was... It's amazing in that sort of incredibly basic Russian fatalism and realism. That's how I took it anyway, Latika. Particularly, I suppose, that remark about Melnichenko, the man who's spoken out and that he saw that it was such a complete and utter plant, and the fact that he agreed with you that there's basically, even among Democrats in Russia, there's sort of still an imperialist dream. That's what we were told when we were travelling through Poland. That's pretty devastating, isn't it, to hear?
I mean, this is what you hear in Ukraine all the time, is that there's no such thing as a good Russian, there's only a good thing as a dead Russian, you know, on it goes. But they do come to this point that even the so-called, and I guess you could, if they cared for democracy or anti-corruption or anti-Putin forces, still don't disavow an imperialist Russia, because according to Ukrainians, that's the Russian psyche, that's the Russian way, and the only way this ends is the complete collapse of the Russian Federation. So I think you see the other side of that with Konstantin, which is this bleak, black cynicism talking about his motherland, isn't it? And that is so common with Russians in exile everywhere I go.
Oh, I agree. As he said to us before we started recording, you go away to Portugal or wherever, and they're everywhere, the Russian exiles. And what one reads is that as the war has become more, the special military operation become more problematic, men are not going out onto the streets as much, literally, lest they be picked up.
Which is what's happening in Ukraine, by the way, and the Russians have been going nuts on their propaganda on that. So that's interesting that that's now happening to them, yes.
Yes, even the wives are saying, I'll do the shopping, don't come out except at night. So, you know, I suppose it just has to get a whole lot worse. It has to get a whole lot worse before there is some breakthrough.
I don't know, Geraldine. Look, tapping my head, touch wood, I do feel like the shift from the Trump administration is more significant this time. I really do. Maybe I'm being a little...
What, the fact that they're giving Patriot missiles to the Ukrainians, for instance?
Well, they've given them a license, which will take several years to come online.
A license to build.
Apart from that, the Ukrainians have made some incredible progress on the front line, aside from the ballistic missiles, which they do need the Patriots to take down. They can't do that homegrown yet. But I also do think that at this stage in the game, Trump coming back around onto Ukraine's side, I don't think that's an accident. And I do think, look, again, touching wood, I do think maybe that's more lasting this time than it has been.
But what would it mean? I mean, just follow that through for a moment. You mean that they would then land things in near the Kremlin, as Konstantin was saying? Is that what you're getting at?
I think the Ukrainians, if they had the right amount of weaponry, would be unstoppable. Now, that's actually one of the limitations that was kind of existing around the first few years of the full-scale invasion. But Ukrainians have made some incredible, incredible progress on the Russian economy by taking out oil refineries, which is really one of the key targets. They've taken out lots of drone factories. If they were able to get to the source of things like where Russia is making ballistic missiles that are causing all this awful death and destruction in the main cities, including Kyiv, I mean, then you do start to look at a situation where Russia's running out of options. But we're not there yet, far away from there.
I fear we're not. So, look, it's been fabulous to be back on air and talking to you, Latika. It's cooler, is it, finally, in the UK?
It's lovely since I last saw you here, Geraldine. 25 degrees, which in my book is the most perfect English summer weather.
Indeed. There's nothing as beautiful as a good English summer. Truly, there is nothing quite as delightful. Look, keep your questions and feedback do coming. We really do love hearing from you, and we do let it influence us. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. For now, Latika, bye-bye.
See you, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.